Welcome back to another edition of Natsukashi. We talk a little bit about our nostalgic experiences with film, how the perception may have changed over time. We distance ourselves maybe 10 to 20 years of a film that we witnessed in childhood, and we kind of look at it again, and we view it through the same eyes, and we view the same film, but sometimes we have a completely different perspective of what we've seen. And tonight, we're going to look at a film from 1953 called The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T. And with me, I have...
This is Scott from He Shot Cyrus out in San Francisco.
Scott from He Shot Cyrus. Scott is one of the earliest Natsukashi supporters, and I have to give a big shout out to Scott because he's been giving us some great feedback, and he's introduced us to a great community out here, and I highly recommend checking out his blog. He's got some very entertaining entries and very perceptive and astute observations on film. So please check out heshotcyrus.blogspot.com. Is that right?
Yeah. He-shot-cyrus. I'm sure there'll be a link up.
Yeah, there's a link on Natsukashi to it. If you're listening to this right now, then you're obviously on the Natsukashi page. So there's a link to it on your right-hand side. Move the mouse right over there. No down, two more. Right there. Perfect. Okay. Click onto it after you're done listening to this and check out what Scott has to say.
No! Get away! Get away! No! Go on away! Go on away!
Here, boy. Here. What's the matter?
Dr. Terwilliger, what happened? What's going on around here?
Dreaming again. I can't leave the room for 5 minutes. What were you dreaming about this time?
I was being chased by a big bunch of men with nets.
Nets? Why can't you dream about practicing the piano?
I'll try.
Don't you realize if you don't practice, you'll never become a concert pianist? Practice makes perfect.
I'm trying to practice.
1 month to get that piece learned before my recital. 1 month before I present all my pupils in a grand concert. And I'm not going to let one dreary little boy humiliate me, do you understand?
I don't think the piano's my instrument.
What other instruments are there, pray tell? Scratchy violins? Screechy piccolos? Nauseating trumpets? Etc., etc.? We'll make a Paderewski of you yet.
Who?
Paderewski.
Oh.
Now I want you to practice and practice and practice until you are perfect. Good day, young man.
Tell us a little bit about your history with this, Scott.
Like any true cinephile, we used to go to the library as a kid, and instead of checking out the book section, ran straight to the video section. Piled up a big stack of VHS tapes back then and begged my mom to let us take them home. And, found this 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T one day. I read the Dr. Seuss books and had seen the whole series of the 70s or 80s cartoon series.
Right.
And so this was the first live-action Seuss movie that I didn't even know existed.
And it was just because it had the name Dr. Seuss on there that initially caught your attention and said, you've got to have this.
Yeah, it was like, the cover's a trip. It's really colorful, and there's this little boy, Bart. He's got this yellow hand beanie.
Right.
I don't know if I would have given it the chance that I did if it wasn't Dr. Seuss, but I took it home anyway and loved it. Probably wore their tape off.
So you owe the library a whole 10 cents, 15 cents for it?
Sometimes I think that Dr. Terwilliger has my mother hypnotized. Holy mackerel, I'll bet you that she... That noise you hear is my friend, Mr. Zabludowski the plumber. He knows all about the piano, but he's afraid to say so in front of my mother. He thinks Dr. Terwilliger's a real racketeer. A 100% gold-plated phony. Double phony.
What did you remember before your most recent screening of it? What parts of this film stood out in your mind?
I remember the sets. I remember just like what a huge scale these sets were built on. Just from the like the ladder
right.
to nowhere, to the lighting, to the buildings, to the mechanical hands playing the piano. And the piano, the 500 boy piano, is a trip, and it still is when you see it now.
Yeah, it's just this swirling, almost rolling meadow of black and white keys, really.
Yeah, and it makes no sense to have a curve like that.
I talk about German Expressionism in my class, and that I think Dr. Seuss, his real name, Theodor Geisel, got a lot of his books, and obviously you can see it in this film that there was this German expressionistic look to this entire film, from the tilting hallways to, like you said, the Ladder to Nowhere, to the, you know, the curved hands. Everything about it seemed to have this, you know, this very German expressionistic feel to it. Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, Nosferatu, and the like.
Definitely. Actually, it was a friend of mine and I were talking about how they just found that new print, supposed to be the whole feature for Metropolis, and how excited we were about that. And that's what kicked this movie back up into my memory, because the sets on Metropolis are so, you know, you're so reminiscent when you watch 5,000 Fingers. It's just gigantic. Like, nobody builds rooms that size. And that piano, the way it just curves and moves with it, definitely right with the German Expressionism.
Okay, so the set design itself, and were there particular scenes or performances that kind of stuck with you all these years?
Yeah. The two brothers,
yes,
connected
the roller skating.
Whitney and Judson.
Picture, if you will, if Thing 1 and Thing 2 from the Cat in the Hat books grew up to be two Orthodox Jews, and that's essentially what these guys look like. They went around on roller skates connected by their long gray beard. And what was it about them? Aside from the obvious.
They're on roller skates. And as it turns out later, I looked it up, and they were professional roller skaters. And they just tear through these sets, farther together, close together, just spinning around things, all connected by this big gray beard. And that's something I'd never seen. I still haven't seen. I can't believe nobody's ripped that off yet. It's gross if you think about it. You gotta think, how did the beard get connected to the tumor? Tumor, because you cut it. They don't respond well.
That was their demise, was the cutting of, the severing of this beard. So you wonder if there was some sort of, you know, fleshy matter underneath it that held their shared heart or something.
Yeah, and that's the other thing, is what, having a kid's movie where you have characters actually die without getting crushed by a rock or falling off a cliff. Like, they died from a pair of gardening shears.
Exactly.
So that stuck with me.
Early slasher film.
Yeah. And then because it's not like they take them off screen.
Yeah.
No, they like die right on camera, right in front of you. And I thought Dick Van Dyke had done it. So I was having Mary Poppins flashbacks. Turns out that I don't know the guy's name.
That's Peter Lynn Hayes, who actually was a pretty big television star. In fact, I had his own television series briefly with the woman who played Bart's mom in this, Mary Healy. Both of them were married in real life and acted together in quite a few films.
10 little dancing maidens dancing, oh so fine. 10 happy little fingers, and they're mine, all mine. They're mine, they're mine. Now isn't that just fine? Not 3, not 5, not 7, and not 9. But 10 all dancing straight in line. And all of them are mine.
Now you have it.
And the villain is fantastic. The guy that the guy with the beards worked for.
He was the voice of Captain Hook in Peter Pan, and he was Snidely Whiplash, and a very distinctive voice, and very kind of this androgynous, comical villain, who really at some points had this wardrobe that I think even Liberace would turn down and say, that's way too gay, I'm sorry.
Yeah, incredible. And, of course, like, there's a song about it.
Yeah, can...
There's a big, long Dress Me song.
Can we sidetrack on that a minute? We talked briefly before this conversation. There was a writer for The Simpsons who must have absolutely loved this film. I don't know if you picked up on how many references there were.
Well, even the last name,
there you go.
Dr. T. Terwilliger, that's
Sideshow
Bob's
last name. Exactly. Not only that, but and I know Bart was named after, I think it was named after Matt Groening's grandfather, but still, there was a Bart in this, there was the Terwilliger, there was the See My Vest-like number, the Montgomery, that Montgomery Burns sings in a particular episode, a 101 Dalmatians episode of The Simpsons.
Yeah.
And it's See My Vest made of real gorilla chest. And he talks about all these animals that were slain for this film or for this outfit that he was wearing. And it echoed so strongly to, you know, one of the kind of cornerstone songs in this with he said, "Come on and dress me, dress me, dress me in my silver garters, diamond studs. I want my undulating undies with the marabou frills." I won't even get into the undulating undies, but beautiful bolero with my porcupine quills. "I want my purple nylon girdle with an orange blossom buds, because I'm going to do-me-doing in my do-me-dough duds."
"I want my undulating undies with the marabou frills. I want my beautiful bolero with the porcupine quills. I want my purple nylon girdle with the orange blossom buds, 'cause I'm going do-me-do-ing in my do-me-do duds. Come on and dress me, dress me, dress me in my peekaboo blouse, with the lovely interlining made of Chesapeake mouse. I want my polka-dotted dickie with the crinoline fringe, or I'm going do-me-do-ing on a do-me-do binge. I want my lavender spats, and in addition to them, I want my honey-colored gusset with the herringbone hem. I want my softest little jacket made of watermelon suede, and my long persimmon placket with the platinum braid. I want my leg of mutton sleeves, and in addition to those, I want my cutie chamois booties with the leopard skin bows. I want my pink brocaded bodice with the fluffy fuzzy ruffs, and my gorgeous bright blue bloomers with the monkey feather cuffs. I want my organdy snood, and in addition to that, I want my chiffon Mother Hubbard lined with Hudson Bay rat. Dress me up from top to bottom, dress me up from tip to toe, dress me up in silk and spinach, for today is do-me-do, do-me-do day, do-me-do day. So come and dress me in the blossoms of a million pink."
That and The Ladder to Nowhere, which you just mentioned too, was very similar to the monorail episode of The Simpsons with the escalator to nowhere.
I had no idea. I mean, I put the Terwilliger together, but you're totally right about that. The See My Vest, directly lifted from that number, which I'm glad to see some good came out of it, because it was really not needed in this. But I think if you were to take out all the unneeded song and dance numbers from this, it'd be a short at best.
They do.
They sing about everything. And I had no recollection of that from a kid. I don't know how I sat through all that. My poor parents. They must have heard "dress me, dress me, dress me" like 90
and
million
that...
times. That's my biggest change from the new screening.
This dungeon in Dr. T's elaborate castle or labyrinth or whatever it is, his music school, but it's almost like a prison encampment, really. And in the dungeon dwells all of the instruments that are not keyboard related. So it's kind of like the island of misfit music.
Yeah, the guard says he takes one by one, he kidnaps other musicians and locks them in the dungeon,
right,
so they'll only be piano players. Because he doesn't even recognize that there are other... He doesn't recognize basketball or baseball or piccolos
or
violin.
First floor dungeon, assorted simple tortures, molten lead, chopping blocks, and hot boiling oil. Second floor. history department. Leg chains, ankle chains, neck chains, wrist chains, thumbs, screws, and nooses of the very finest rope.
And this dungeon is populated with these damned instruments, these instruments that are you know, eternally damned. And that one musical number must last. I mean, it was probably as long as Inagata De Vita, I would say.
Yeah, it goes on and on. But you got to admit, it's so
very
visually impressive, and it's musical without lyrics. But it goes on and on. But I love the Dr. Seuss created instruments. You know, you've got your drums, you've got your violins and whatever, and then you've got these crazy-looking horns that you know he came up with.
Yeah, very Seussy, and it felt like you were in a very dank, shackled version of Whoville.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was great how Dr. Seuss did the story, co-wrote the screenplay, wrote all the lyrics for the songs, and then he worked with Alan Scott, who did Imitation of Life. And a couple of Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers movies. And so that combination seemed to work really well because you've got the dance numbers, the choreography, but you've got the Dr. Seuss lyrics within that story, and it just all came together to come up with something that I've never seen anything like it.
It was also produced by Stanley Kramer, and Stanley Kramer was known probably by a lot of cinephiles as the producer of Death Salesman and Inherit the Wind. So this was a gamble after, I think, several years of kind of fair to poorly performing films from him. And this one was poorly received as well. He was known for some very serious, weighty films, and this was quite the opposite for him.
Should we dance?
Don't mind if I do.
Come on, it's time we got together, cause it's get-together weather, and in get-together weather, together is just what we got to get.
Come on, the weatherman's insisting, this is weather beyond resisting, this is get-together weather, together is just what we got to get.
What wonderful weather to go on an outing.
What wonderful weather to run around shouting.
What wonderful weather for love to be sprouting.
It's mighty fine weather, I hope that it stays.
What glorious weather for zipping and zooming.
What glorious weather for hearts to be blooming.
What glorious weather for briding and grooming.
It's mighty fine weather, we're having these days.
Yeah, right. To go from this to Guess Who's Coming to Dinner.
Yeah, nice segue.
Yeah. And then the lead actor who plays Bart, I had to look up what else I had seen him in, and turns out a couple of seasons of Lassie, which he got his role from working with the dog in this one. And then he went on to become a really well-known computer programmer.
He probably honed those skills while sitting in front of the 5,000-keyed keyboard of Dr. T. The plot of this movie is very simplistic. It's essentially Tommy Redding, who was the little boy Bart in this. His mom wants him to practice piano, and he doesn't want to. And Dr. Terwilliger, you know, is this draconian figure who wants him to sit night and day until his fingers bleed and continue to play. And really, this whole world that he inhabits is essentially just a dream sequence from young Bart.
And it's great that they address that it's a dream from the beginning. Because when you go into a Dr. Seuss world, it's just like Salvador Dali and like surrealism. You know, it's this great mixture between surrealism, Dr. Seuss, German Expressionism, and it's just what a little boy's fantasy or nightmare world would look like, you know, from everything being really big to things that don't quite make sense because in a dream they don't have to. And if you had found another way for him to enter this world and then at the end told you it was a dream, the film definitely wouldn't work as well. It's very, it's like Wizard of Oz. But then at the end, there was that parallel when he asked them, like, oh, when did you hurt your thumb? He's like, when you hurt yours. And
of Dreams of Leon. And
this was made in 1953, or it was released in 1953, and it has a feel of the 60s and 70s, like Santa Claus Conquers the Martians or something like that. You can see this fitting in that vein because the 60s and 70s were a little bit more trippier with their kids' pictures and, you know, weren't afraid to kind of roll the dice a little bit and get a little darker and a little... But the 50s were so Leave It to Beaver-esque for children's films that this was a bigger gamble than you would think in looking at this. And if you put the time into perspective, the time that it was released into perspective, then it was quite a gamble.
You know, maybe that's why they did one live action film while he was alive. And then, you know, now you've got Cat in the Hat to add to that. So, strike two. You can go either way on the Grinch movie.
In looking at all these films, this is obviously worlds better than the overproduced Cat in the Hat and Grinch films because of its simplicity. And I think it had echoes of the kind of simplistic, monochromistic pages of a Dr. Seuss book.
Yeah, definitely. The look to it, the feel of it, like the world that it creates. And you're right about the simplicity, too, because the story works on a lot of levels. You have the...
Right.
You know, it's after World War II. What year was this? You've got, like, the little boy with no father, which I'm sure a lot of little boys who were, you know, this came out 8 years after World War II ended, about the same age as Bart, and so he's longing for a father, and he looks for it in his plumber, and
eventually finds
it in the dream. But I think it's an interesting parallel how that works with the end of World War II, and interesting that a film like this wasn't more successful because it had so many things that you would think the people after the war were looking for.
Zabludowski, the plumber character of whom you spoke, he drives off at the end in this army service, the 6th Jeep, and he has a Korean conflict battle jacket, leather jacket, and that he's wearing in the final scene. So,
and it's still very 50s. It's still very Leave It to Beaver. Just look at the, you know, who his mother is and how she relates to the other characters and her whole performance and look and everything. You know, it's very Leave It to Beaver. Even within the dream world, it still works. Then, I have to say that this just popped in my head from the pre-screening. Somehow I'd gotten it mixed up and I could have sworn that Dr. Pulitzer was played by Balky from Perfect Strangers.
He'd be quite old now, Bronson Pinchot.
Yeah, those things just don't connect when you're a little kid,
you know,
I guess. I could have sworn it was him. And I could have sworn that the plumber was Dick Van Dyke.
That's the wonder of nostalgia, my friend.
Yeah, that's exactly why like this sort of thing is important. You can go back and at least get the casting right. At least know who you were watching times.
Listen, and I'll try it.
We got to talk about a very atomic. That very atomic line is just the best. For those who haven't seen it, it's just, once again, coming after World War II to break out of the dungeon. They decide to, I forgot what they call it, but
yeah,
it's just a noise catcher.
We'll call it a Deus Ex Machina, because that's really what it was. I mean, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, this guy says, I have an idea. Here. And he pulls out this bottle of Airfix, which, for those unfamiliar with the Deus, it's Latin meaning God in the machine, and it's a commonly used cinematic device that kind of is dropped into the lap of the heroes of a film that has no prior mention whatsoever, and yet comes to save the day. So,
yeah, it's like, oh, well, I'm glad you had that. How convenient. And of course, you can just turn, take a bad smell out of the air to take noise out of the air by crushing up all these things the little boy has in his pocket,
exactly.
Which was awesome, by the way, because that totally rang back to when I was a kid. He just like pulls like, oh, I have some jacks. I have
Here's my Communist Party card.
Yeah. So, yeah, and then to suck the music out of the air and shut down the whole school. Brilliant.
So in this most recent viewing, are there other things?
I think it was the details, the attention to detail, okay, and all of the little things that really held up. From pulling out the food cart from the ground out of nowhere, or the vintage pickle juice, or the ladder to nowhere. All these like little details that are so crazy for any movie, kids' movies especially, just have it work that way. That's what really, really stuck out this time. And that you could tell that there was a lot of thought that went into each one of them. Even from the way the hands were drawn, like, oh, go up this staircase through the hole in the floor to go see your mom,
right,
or Dr. T the other way. Just all those little details are really what stuck out. But the 14-plus dance numbers and song numbers, that didn't hold up at all. The dungeon scene is still really impressive, and that's another one of those with the details that sure wowed me as a kid. But the Dress Me song, that was hard. We're just a kid, nobody listens to us song was difficult.
Now just because we're kids, because we're sort of small, because we're closer to the ground, and you are bigger pound by pound, you have no right to push and shove us little kids around. Now just because your throat has got a deeper voice and lots of wind to blow it out at little kids who don't dare shout, you have no right to boss and beat us little kids about.
There are plenty of them. I can't even remember them all now, but
there was, and like you said, if you whittled it down, it would essentially be, it would fit in a YouTube video. So,
yeah.
Scott, I appreciate you your contribution to it. Please check out his musings, where you'll see him in his peekaboo blouse with lovely inner lining made of Chesapeake mouse. He's polka dotted Dickie with a crinoline fringe.
Don't spoil anything.
Check him out on heshotcyrus.blogspot.com and come back and visit us again. Scott, thank you very much.
Hey, thanks so
much.
Now isn't that too glorious? Our nasty team, notorious. Us gruesome, grimy, glorious. Us stinkers are victorious. We ain't too meek, we ain't too bright, but nevertheless we won tonight. Unthinkable, stinkable, horrible, us, hooray! We are victorious, victorious.